Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. Radio, and later television, forever changed the way that people get their news about politics. Today, the engine of that change is the Internet. And this morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be considering one of the most powerful forces in American politics today, online journalism. And our guest is Eric Bollert, and we'll be talking about some of what you will find in his recently published book, Bloggers on the Bus. The subtitle is How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press, and it's published by Free Press. It charts the rise of the liberal blogosphere and its role, particularly in elections in 2006 and perhaps more important in 2008. Questions are welcome as we talk. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So questions, comments are welcome. We do ask people to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible. We hope people will stay focused on the topic. Other than that, your comments and questions are welcome. Mr. Bollert, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. I think that we probably should begin by explaining that the title of your book is a nod to an earlier book, and this is one that, well, people who know about journalism, it's quite a well-known book about political reporting. It's been a while now. This was back in from the early 70s, and this was a book titled The Boys on the Bus, which was about reporters who followed political candidates. You want to talk just a second about that?
Sure. That was by Timothy Krause, and as you said, it's really a landmark book in journalism and politics. And it was about the 1972 campaign, and Timothy Krause was a very young reporter who followed the campaign and the press and really drew back the curtain for the first time and showed and introduced Americans to political journalists. In the past, there wasn't the celebrity journalism culture like we have today, and most people had paid no attention whatsoever to the bylines of campaigns and political journalism. And TV journalists at the time were, just sort of stand-up guys with a microphone who gave updates on the campaign. Again, there wasn't sort of this celebrity culture and branding that we have now today with Beltway journalists. And Boys on the Bus, again, sort of drew the curtain back and explained who these powerful players were, who were these people who helped shape the narrative. And one of the emphases on that book was the pack mentality and how it came to be and how it was so powerful within the political journalists who covered campaigns. And my book is a nod to that in a way. And I wanted to sort of draw the curtain back and show who are these bloggers that we hear so much about, and particularly on the liberal bloggers, and to show, like the Boys on the Bus, who were these people? They had interesting life stories. There was an interesting dynamic, and how did they come to this position, and things like that. Because obviously, there's been a lot written about bloggers, but to me, it seemed rather faceless, and the mainstream press didn't really seem to show much interest in really painting in any kind of sort of vivid or entertaining portrait in terms of who these liberal bloggers are and how they had come to really change the landscape in politics and the press.
Yeah. I think the important point here, sometimes I think maybe this phrase we toss around mainstream media is maybe a tiny bit unfair, but the fact of the matter is that an awful lot of the media, the way they report on politics, that it's very much from one source to another, it's the same story. And reporters, they do tend to travel in a pack, and that administrations and candidates and politicians have learned very well how to control the message.
That's
and
right.
So the argument goes that what you really need is you need people who are outside of the bubble, as it's been called, people both liberals and conservatives, people of different sorts stripes that are outside of that, who are going to be more independent, and that now I think your argument is, and a lot of people appreciate that, people like that are maybe in a better position to break stories, to come up with something that has not been reported by the other media, in a better position to do that than are the reporters that are working for the more established, old-line, mainstream news organization.
Yeah, and the key is there being outside the bubble. It's interesting. The name of the book is Bloggers on the Bus, but very few of the bloggers actually got on the bus because the feeling is now that probably the least interesting and the least insightful place to be on a campaign is to be on the bus because, as you mentioned, campaigns have honed over the years this ability to say virtually nothing while they campaign. And so you have these horde of mainstream reporters following them around while they say very little and then documenting how little they say. So there is this bubble, and even the people who are in the bubble would acknowledge it's probably, as I said, one of the least interesting and insightful places to be. And so the bloggers were some of the people who sort of created their own bus or their own community or their own way to watch and dissect campaigns. And they were able, as I point out in the book, to break important news. And more times than not, they were able to create different narratives or different insights or just produce a different voice, a voice that did not robotically echo the conventional wisdoms of the bubble and a voice that was not, slavishly dedicated to sort of process and polling the way the mainstream press is, particularly during the final months of any presidential campaign.
This book, you're really focusing here on liberal bloggers.
Yes.
And as I said, and I'm sure people understand, there are bloggers of all political stripes. Do you think that there is some way in which, though, that liberal bloggers have become more, I hesitate to say important, maybe influential is a better kind of word, than have conservative bloggers?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt, and I make that claim in the book. And then because liberal bloggers and the blogosphere and the larger sort of Netroots online community and movement, sort of the progressive movement online, bloggers have become so much more than what they started out as. They started out as basically critics of the Bush administration and critics of the press, and they wrote about both of those insightfully and sort of incessantly, and they've expanded their base, and they now help pick congressional candidates. They fundraise. They launch, policy initiatives. They're, for instance, incredibly involved right now in the health care debate and trying to shape that debate and working the Hill and things like that. President Obama had his first conference call with liberal bloggers this week in a way to try to help generate their support to affect the larger debate. Conservative bloggers are essentially what they were 5 years ago, which are, just sort of opinion writers who basically tell the readers each day why they hate Democrats and why they hate the press. They haven't evolved into anything else. They're not politically motivated, I don't think. They raise no money whatsoever for candidates. They don't push, most of them don't back individual candidates and congressional races and things like that. And more importantly, as I point out in the book, the conservative blogosphere has become completely bogged down in this sort of nonstop conspiracy theory dialogue. The intellectual standards are sort of non-existent, and they just chase sort of loopy story after loopy story, and then none of them ever really materialize, and then they just sort of move on to the next. I'll give you a couple of recent examples.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of weeks ago, they were all excited because they had uncovered this broad conspiracy theory that for the Chrysler bankruptcy, the Chrysler, hundreds of dealerships were closed across the country, and they decided after sort of half-baked reporting that Obama had personally selected which Chrysler dealerships were going to be closed down, and he was punishing the Chrysler dealership owners who hadn't donated to Democratic candidates in the past. So Obama was sort of single-handedly orchestrating this payback against car ownerships of all people because he's a mean Chicago politician and that's what they do. And this was like a big deal for a few days in the conservative blogosphere, and they all blogged about it. Michelle Malkin went on Fox News, and they all hyped it. And, of course, there's absolutely nothing to support it. But they got all excited, and because it sort of fit the caricature or sort of this fantasy of the Barack Obama that they have. And the fact that it was based on nothing and it was sort of comical didn't stop them, and then it sort of just imploded, and they moved on to the next one. The liberal blogosphere, in literally like 7 years of existence, has never for a day, in terms of the A-list liberal bloggers, adopted or hyped a story as silly as the Chrysler story. And the conservative bloggers have probably hyped hundreds of stories like that over the years. So that's why I think one is much more serious and important than the other.
Our guest is Eric Bollaert. He's an award-winning journalist. He writes extensively about media and politics. He's a senior fellow for Media Matters for America, former writer for Salon and Rolling Stone. He's author of the previous book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. And his new book is titled Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. It's published by Free Press. And as we've explained it, it looks at particularly the liberal bloggers and their impact on politics and on media. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have a caller here not too far away, the community of Belgium, and that's line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'd like to take a step or two back from where you folks are at right now. The founding fathers definitely believed in freedom of the press. Now, freedom of the press to them was a newspaper, okay? Now, today, newspapers are dying, and the reason why newspapers are dying has a certain amount to do with the fact that we have television, radio, and now, as you pointed out, the internet and computers. Well, each one of these steps starts excluding more and more people out of the process because they don't have access to the technology, which in Civil War times was totally different. Everybody read a newspaper. Prior to that, they had, the penny press or something like that. But if you see what I'm saying, these steps you're taking forward really aren't really getting a larger percentage of the people, I don't think. It's beginning to exclude people because they don't have the capability to be involved.
Well, it's an interesting point, and you're right. I mean, the sort of the running conversation in America in terms of the internet is that everyone's on the internet, and then everyone has access to the computer. I mean, now in terms of having access to at least dial-up or having a phone line you can use for a computer, I would suggest that sort of the penetration rate is very high, and in fact, we still have sort of this assumption when we have a media debate that everyone has cable TV and everyone has access to hundreds of channels. That's certainly not true. I mean, my cable bill is almost $50 a month. I mean, there are millions of people in America who don't have cable TV. But again, when you talk about the media or politics, the general assumption is everyone has access to the channels. I think it's probably a little more true in terms of computers, but it's an important point. You're right. Not everyone has a laptop. Not everyone has a PC. Not everyone has high-speed internet. Not everyone can watch all those videos on YouTube with a dial-up. So it's an important point because it does get overlooked. But if I had to compare it in terms of access to computers versus access to cable television, my hunch is the computers is probably a bit higher.
Well, I was referring going back to newspaper because everybody could get a newspaper even if it wasn't fresh. You could read something that somebody had already read.
Yeah.
What I'm saying. So it was a lot more people seemed to be more involved in politics when there was a newspaper.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would argue in the last 10 years, I think, and in the Obama campaign show, I think the internet helped bring a lot more people into the process, into the political process, because of the internet. And the Obama campaign was able to connect people online as well as offline. So I would say there's a pretty good argument to be made that the internet has helped in at least some small way to bring people back in to political participation because it's helped connect people in a way they hadn't been connected before.
Thank you very much.
All right. Other questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. What I think is really striking here, given how important bloggers have been, particularly in the last presidential contest, one of the things you argue is that the people that you're talking about, liberal bloggers, really at first didn't take to Obama, and he really didn't take to them, which is really interesting because the Obama campaign embraced the internet as a means of putting out its message and maybe most important, a means of raising money.
I think he raised something like $500 million of his money online. Of two-thirds of all the money he raised. Yeah, I mean, the conventional wisdom is, you know, Barack Obama was the internet candidate, and the internet loved him, and he was able to use it and the blogosphere to his advantage. And it's true, the bloggers did support him, I think, overwhelmingly over Hillary Clinton, for instance, if you go back to the Democratic primary. But what gets lost in that is the fact that the Obama campaign had almost nothing to do with the bloggers themselves. Obama himself as a candidate, I think, was probably more centrist than the bloggers, and he was just not comfortable with their sort of combative partisan rhetoric. And so he was quite plain. I mean, he told reporters he doesn't read blogs. He had suggested that, you know, the bloggers were sort of out of touch. So it was an interesting dynamic to see that standoffishness, yet him receive this sort of overwhelming love from the bloggers themselves. And there's still a debate, I think, going on quietly among bloggers, looking back, you know, was that a mistake? Did they give away too much of their leverage by supporting a candidate who did not necessarily support their agenda? You know, it's interesting in the healthcare debate right now. If you went back to, say, December 2007 or January 2008, sort of the number one prerogative for bloggers in terms of healthcare was universal healthcare, universal healthcare, universal healthcare. Any Democratic nominee has got to be in support of universal health care. And Hillary Clinton was, and Barack Obama was not necessarily. But it was Barack Obama who won the overwhelming endorsement of the blogosphere. And now we're having that debate about health care. And some of the Clinton bloggers, I think, are saying, well, you know, we told you so. So it's an interesting dynamic. It's sort of an intramural debate that's going on. But it was certainly interesting to watch the Obama campaign keep its distance from the bloggers throughout the basically the entire campaign.
Well, once Mr. Obama was elected, did liberal bloggers, has there been any tendency for them to start to say, start to complain that perhaps Obama said he would do one thing and now he's doing something else, or they're saying things like, well, we thought we knew who this guy was and what he stood for, and now we're not so sure?
Well, there has been that. There has absolutely been a very healthy criticism of the Democratic administration. You know, a lot of blogger critics, particularly conservatives, said, oh, well, you know, watch, after Obama's inaugurated, you're gonna see the true colors of these liberal bloggers. They're a bunch of lapdogs. They're just cheerleaders. They don't really stand for anything. And the fact is, if you want articulate, thoughtful criticism of the Obama administration, you find most of it online among liberal bloggers who have been quite vocal in terms of his positions on gay marriage, gays in the military, wiretapping. Obama White House essentially continued the Bush administration policy, which was overwhelmingly criticized by the liberal bloggers. Bloggers like Glenn Greenwald are just as critical of Obama as they were of Bush in terms of wiretapping. So I guess in terms of a movement, I think it's good and it's healthy to see the liberal bloggers essentially staying true to their calling. And their calling was never to be an appendage to the Democrat National Committee. The liberal blogosphere wasn't created to just sort of mindlessly cheer Democratic politicians. Was created to give a voice to sort of a new kind of liberalism in America, and that's what they're doing. And so now they're trying to keep the new Democratic administration accountable. That's not to say they also aren't cheerleading when they love what they see from the Democratic White House, and they're also spending a lot of time playing defense on behalf of the Obama administration against sort of these, you know, unhinged attacks from the right about how Obama's a socialist or a Marxist or he wasn't born in America. So they gladly defend the Obama White House. They gladly cheerlead when they see good things from the White House. But they're also upfront about, you know, being critical.
Do you think now bloggers, and particularly the kinds of big sites websites that specialize in political news but have other kinds of news that have aggregated stuff from a lot of different sources. Have they now – are they to a point where they're challenging the kind of influence of the large traditional news organizations that started out perhaps being broadcasters or being people who worked in print who have moved also into using the internet but whose primary existence is not based in the internet?
Well, in terms of a site that aggregates and things like that, I mean, Huffington Post is the best example.
Yeah.
I mean, that has become a hugely influential hub and site. And I think it has become very important in terms of helping dictate, you know, the media narratives and which stories are important and which stories people are talking about. And I mean, that's a perfect example in terms of the growth of the liberal net roots. You know, that was created after the John Kerry loss, and there was a feeling that there just wasn't a site online that, you know, sort of commanded that kind of respect among the mainstream media. And that was launched in by 2008, during the height of the campaign. I mean, the Huffington Post traffic had doubled, you know, the Drudge Report, which had always been seen as sort of the standard bearer for the, you know, these headline sites and a site that helped create the media narrative and things like that. So I think they, you know, a site like the Huffington Post, which is doing more and more original reporting, they're adding more and more staffers. It's not just headlines. It's not just bloggers. But that is a site that has clearly now occupies the same space that sort of mainstream news organizations did in terms of setting the news agenda.
Hmm. How have the mainstream news organizations responded? And have they done anything that that was really more significant than saying to their own reporters, okay, now you guys have to have your own blogs?
Not only do you have to blog, you have to, you know, file deadlines every 3 hours. Basically, that's been basically it. I mean, they have clearly rushed into this area. They're trying to, you know, they've created their own blogs. Every major news site has probably, you know, at least half a dozen. I mean, the New York Times at this point must have 15 blogs. I mean, not just politics, but sports and fashion, you name it, they've got a blog. Because they realize, you know, the advantages that everyone else realized. It's a much more immediate conversation you're having with readers. They, you know, you don't have to wait until the morning to get the fresh headlines out. And so they wanted to be a part of that. And I don't think there's any question that they've sort of eaten some of that traffic away from sort of the traditional independent bloggers. And, you know, the mainstream sites saw this revolution that was going on online, and sort of they sort of entered it as well, but it's a different animal. I mean, if you're blogging for the New York Times, you're still part of the New York Times. There's, you know, you still have guidelines. If you're a reporter, you can't do opinion, et cetera, et cetera. And the beauty of the blogosphere is sort of the, you know, the naked opinion. I mean, nobody holds back when they're blogging online. Nobody has to worry about what their bosses say and things like that. So it. You know, the New York Times and the Newsweek and all the other sites that blog, I mean, it's sort of blogging light. I mean, it's much more immediate. It is sort of more conversational, but it's still not, I don't really think, sort of blogging in the true sense. It's just sort of trying to piggyback a little bit on that and trying to grab some of that traffic as well.
Yeah. We're at a midpoint here. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and our guest this morning in this hour is Eric Bollert. He writes about media and politics. He's a senior fellow for Media Matters for America. He's been a writer for Salon at Rolling Stone. His most recent book is Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press, and it's published by Free Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I think I should give you an opportunity maybe to talk about some of the people that you write about in the book, because you spend a lot of time profiling individuals. And I guess I think that people have, I'm sure, this stereotype idea in their heads of who it is we're talking about. And I'm really struck here in the introduction. In fact, you talk about one individual whose blogging seemed to become an obsession. It was at one point here where he's talking about the fact that if he didn't post anything for a stretch of 8 hours during the day, his friends and family thought something was wrong. You know, they thought the guy died or had
right.
a stroke or something. And he went on to do a clip of sort of a famous clip that was posted on YouTube, where he essentially said, you can become a full-time progressive blogger as long as you're willing to do nothing else in your entire life. And he goes on to talk about how the qualifications are don't care about having a social life, don't mind being viciously attacked dozens of times every day, don't have a wide range of interests in life, don't like taking vacations, and so on and so forth. You know, that's, I think, the stereotype that people have of the blogger. Is that the kind of people that we're talking about?
Well, the good news is that was Chris Bowers, and he just got married this week.
So oh, glad to hear it. So
he married another blogger.
Oh.
Chris was used to teach English at freshman English at Temple University in Philadelphia, and after 9/11, he became really addicted to his laptop. In between classes, he was reading more and more online, and he was. Finding this burgeoning movement, and he saw his voice finally being reflected and online, and eventually he really just felt a calling and felt like he had to be part of it, and he quit his job at Temple and became a full-time blogger. And he told me a funny story on the eve of the 2004 John Kerry Bush campaign. He had just hit the send button on this long post about sort of analyzing the final data for all the polling and what the likelihood was and things like that. And he had just hit send, and he lost his power and his electricity and his cable connection at his apartment because his $145 Comcast bill was overdue. So he left, you know, he felt like he had to be a part of this movement, and it was a movement that virtually pays nothing and things like that. So those are the type of the people that really did build the liberal blogosphere. And it was interesting because they did it out of a complete sense of frustration. I mean, the liberal blogosphere was created without any sort of fundraising, no money, no coordination. Other bloggers didn't even realize there were other people doing what they were doing for the first year or so. It was just people who were really just tired of throwing things at their television after living through impeachment, after living through the Florida recount, watching the country prepare for the run-up to the war. And they just didn't really feel like any, you know, an actual liberal perspective was being invited into the media conversation. So they figured, well, literally just for their own sanity, they had to get this stuff off their chest. And so they started posting online, and it turns out we found some incredibly talented and creative people who had no connection with professional politics, who had no connection with professional media, who uncovered this unknown sort of talent and interest. And so that all flourished online. In a sense, Chris Bowers was typical of those early bloggers, obsessive. You know, it became not only a passion but sort of a lifestyle. It's become somewhat more professionalized since then. A lot of these sites are no longer written by just one person. There's sort of a team of people who help produce the content because it really is an extraordinarily time-consuming practice. So that part has changed a little bit over the years. There's much more coordination and communication between the bloggers now. But there's still virtually no money at all.
Yeah. Well, I guess that was the next question that was on my mind. Is it actually possible to do this and make a living at it? And then I suppose you might have to ask the question, if the answer is yes, then does it become something different?
Not very many people can make a living independently, just based on the idea is you attract enough readers that you can then sell advertising. I mean, it's just sort of Media 101. I mean, we've been doing this for decades in this country. If your radio station attracts enough listeners, you can sell advertising. If your newspaper, so in theory, that happens with blogs. If you can get a big enough audience who will consistently read you, you can turn around and sell that space to advertisers. Very few are able to do that because the audiences aren't that big, and advertisers are only willing to spend a fraction for for online advertising as they are compared to traditional media advertising. But some people have been able to do it. You know, Daily Coast, obviously, is hugely successful. A site like Eschaton, which is written by Atrios or Duncan Black, Crooks and Liars, Fire Dog Lake. So they're independently owned, and they live off their advertising. But they're definitely few and far between. Most people do it part-time. Most people have another job. Some people might be supported by a foundation or a job, you know, within the political community or a magazine or something like that. But if it does become your job, does it become different? In a way, yes. I think it does because as one of the bloggers I interviewed for the book admitted, you know, they never want to go back to their day job again because this is their calling and they want to keep it their job. And they will admit that does sometimes in small ways influence what they write or what they don't write or what fights they want to pick or what fights they want to avoid. But I think in general the difference is fairly marginal.
Can you give an example or two maybe of really significant stories that were broken by some member of the liberal blogosphere?
Well, I guess during the 2008 campaign, the most famous was Bittergate, which was the story of how Barack Obama at a San Francisco fundraiser, he was asked by a supporter who was going to Pennsylvania to go knock on doors, what should he expect? And Obama, who later called it the biggest boneheaded move of his campaign, talked about how some voters in Pennsylvania were still bitter and they were clinging to guns and religion. And that was a story that was reported by Mayhill Fowler, who was a 60-something housewife from the Oakland, San Francisco area, who was a volunteer writer for the Huffington Post on an initiative they had called Off the Bus, where people wrote locally about grassroots campaigns. And Mayhill Fowler, who was sort of an aspiring novelist and decided she wanted to write about Barack Obama, started in 2007, and she became immediately addicted and fell in love with campaign trail. And soon she spent her own money to spend 3 weeks in Iowa, and then ended up spending almost $50,000 of her own money to travel to cover the campaign, the Democratic primary. And she was a maxed out Obama donor, so she was invited to this fundraiser in San Francisco, and that's where Obama made his comments. And she wasn't sure if she wanted to report them because she thought, and she was right, that they would become a very big deal and they would injure his campaign. But her editor, the Huffington Post, told her, look, you know, if you're going to do journalism, you can't sort of pick and choose what you're going to report based on how it affects your guy or your gal. So they posted it, and it was, you know, just a huge uproar. And it was actually, I don't think there's any doubt in terms of changing voting habits, that it was the biggest story of the Democratic primary. And that marked the moment where Hillary Clinton began her comeback, which fell short. But, you know, that wasn't uncovered by someone from the Times or the Post or NBC. It was from this housewife from Oakland who was covering the campaign voluntarily.
Hmm. We have another caller here to talk with. Let's do that. Someone here in Champaign County where we are. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm more of a audio media person, the chat shows that I listen to around the country, and of course this one. But I do check in on some blogs. But I think in recounting some blogs that have been fairly successful, it seems as there's one that I can't actually go to very often because it uses some kind of Java script that my browser doesn't like, so I need to upgrade. But anyway, I don't want to get into the weeds here. But Mondo Weiss, Phila Weiss, actually, he and a colleague, Horowitz, I think, actually got enough money together to go all the way to the Gaza Strip, and I believe he did a report back at the Brecht Forum rather recently. So, I mean, that to me is an amazing story because there just obviously aren't enough of any kind of journalists in reporting back from from that region. And it seems to me that it it also highlights a fact or something I like to bounce off you, which is that the mainstream media still seems to call the agenda to some extent. There are times when a story bubbles up, and this one that you just gave was, you know, so explosive it obviously would. But it still seems to me that the blogosphere is more reactive to even the liberal blogosphere, left blogosphere is reactive to what the writer's saying or what the mainstream media is saying. And there's a lot of stuff that gets, you know, outside of the allowable debate that doesn't even get focused on. Like, and I thought I'd bounce this off you. For instance, this incident in the coup in Honduras. In your reading around and reading the blogs, did you know that he was actually flown out of a base that is mainly an American base in Palmarola, Honduras? You know, I just find that shocking to my mind that you have to kind of really get into the nitty gritty of reporting from Pacifica to, and I don't think actually it's been mentioned on their flagship show yet, Democracy Now. But so I wanted you to react to some of that, if you would.
Yeah, I think the liberal blogosphere was, as I mentioned, was built around the early days criticizing the Bush administration, criticizing the press. It's definitely still sort of reactive medium in terms of most of the content is still sort of in reaction to what the mainstream press is writing or in reaction to whatever the latest, you know, attacks from the right wing. I think we're seeing slowly, incrementally, more signs of independent reporting or efforts to create their own agenda in hopes that the mainstream media will pick up on that. But I think I still think a lot of bloggers feel most comfortable in a way sort of reacting or critiquing the mainstream press or the right wing and things like that. It's definitely in their DNA. But I do think it would be helpful as it matures and grows if they could, you know, create more original content and maybe not be quite as reactive.
I guess I will admit that I offer that as a bit of a self-criticism because I find myself doing the same thing in the avenues that I have open to me.
Yeah, and
thanks very much.
Yeah. And that goes back to the original reason, you know, the blogosphere was created. It was this frustration in not having a voice and this frustration in seeing these sort of false stories in the press and listening nonstop to, you know, the right wings that dominate or set the agenda. So I still think that feeling is just as strong now as it was 7 years ago, and that is a natural reaction, and hopefully it will be throughout the length of the liberal blogosphere. But they might have enough influence and power now to, in addition to that, also try to create their own agenda.
Well, we talked a little bit earlier, maybe all the way at the beginning, that campaigns, candidates, administrations have become very good at trying to control the message and the access to newsmakers and the kind of information that reporters have, and that one of the advantages perhaps of bloggers is that they were trying to do an end run around that and have a little bit more independence. To what extent have politicians and administrations and candidates now started to realize this is something that is the blogosphere is something they've got to try to have some control over? Maybe they can't have very much, but are they trying to approach it in the same way that they approach more traditional news organizations?
No, I don't think so, because the bloggers don't really care about access. They realize they're not going to get it, therefore it frees them up to sort of do and say whatever they want. The carrot and the stick in terms of politicians or campaigns in the mainstream media is they know, you know, they're still dying for that access. So they can dangle that or use that as retribution, and sort of there's this, you know, this back and forth with politicians and the press over access. They can't really play that game with bloggers because bloggers, access doesn't mean anything to them because they're not going to get it anyway. So they don't really have that weapon. so they don't really have much of any way of controlling the blogosphere, again, because their number one initiative or sort of weapon, they don't really have in their holster because it's just not realistic.
Well, though, are we going? We have seen a little bit, and I wonder whether we're going to see more examples of, for example, bloggers at presidential press conferences, or maybe the president or some high-placed administration official actually sitting down and doing and agreeing to an interview with a blogger in the way that they do with other journalists.
Well, it's interesting. During the campaign, we saw, for instance, Hillary Clinton had conference calls with liberal bloggers. John McCain at some point had conference calls with conservative bloggers. As I mentioned this week, for the first time, President Obama had one with liberal bloggers over the issue of health care and trying to, win over support and things like that. Obama famously at his first White House press conference called on a writer from the Huffington Post. And so we've seen that, and he called on another at his most recent one. So I think this White House is obviously much more open to the idea of at least acknowledging that there is a media revolution taking place, and that bloggers or online news outlets should now be part of the media conversation. Will we see a president interviewed by a blogger? Absolutely. I have no idea if it'll be 10 months from now or 8 years from now, but sure, absolutely, that'll happen.
Our guest, Eric Bollert, writes about media and politics. He's a senior fellow for Media Matters for America. He's written for both Salon and Rolling Stone. His most recent book, the one we're talking about here this morning, is titled Bloggers on the Bus. The subtitle is How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press, and it's published by Free Press. And we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Certainly questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. One thing maybe I have you talk some more about is the something that that bloggers really invested a lot of energy in, and you have a chapter about is the fight over the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Talk about that.
Well, FISA is as I pointed out, for the blogosphere, there are sort of three defining issues over the years. One was Bush in the Iraq War. The other was the Scooter Libby case in the outing of a CIA agent and FISA. And FISA was the shorthand. FISA is the shorthand for the Bush administration's attempt to essentially circumvent existing law, which said that if you wanted to wiretap or eavesdrop on electronic communications involving Americans, you had to have prior approval. And the FISA legislation was created out of in wake of the Nixon years, in which they wiretapped and eavesdropped on thousands of Americans. And so, at the time, a new law was created, and it had been used and updated over the years, and everyone seemed to think it worked fine. And after 9/11, the Bush administration, without really telling anyone, basically said, we're going to ignore FISA and we're going to start wiretapping people because we want to. And so the blogosphere had always made this one of their key points of contention. And in 2007, it looked like the Democratic Congress was about to sign off on the Bush administration's request that not only codified the wiretapping, but also granted retroactive immunity to any of the big telecoms like Verizon or Comcast that helped the Bush administration eavesdrop and wiretap Americans. And for the blogosphere, that was just sort of too much. Why would you give retroactive immunity to these telecoms, A, if they did nothing wrong, and B, if they did, why is the government okaying lawbreaking? And there was a story in the Washington Post that said, Senator Rockefeller, the Democrat, was signing off, and the Democratic Congress were essentially going to give the White House whatever they wanted. And the bloggers started this revolt, and they were led by folks like Glenn Greenwald online, and they just really just started raising holy hell and contacting congressman's office and flooding the Clinton and Obama campaigns and, at the time, John Edwards' campaign. And amazingly, they were able to basically fight this off for 7 or 8 months in Congress. And, you know, they had no lobbyists. They didn't spend a dime on publicists. They had the media wouldn't really report on the whole FISA story. But behind the scenes, they were able to completely change the conversation about wiretapping. And in the end, they felt like they were completely let down by candidate Barack Obama, who during the primary said he would support an attempt to filibuster any FISA legislation. But then after he secured the nomination, he had sort of had a change of mind and would not filibuster it. In fact, he supported the legislation. And that set off all sorts of introspection online in terms of how the liberal bloggers should be dealing with candidate Barack Obama. But again, I mean, in terms of the larger issue of wiretapping, that was just something, an issue that the blogosphere cared passionately about. And they decided to take it on their own, and they almost, against all the odds, defeated the Bush White House on legislation that even Democrats in Congress supported.
I think that certainly at one time, and maybe this is still true, that as people think about bloggers and what they do, they think of them as being perhaps the equivalent to the people whose writing appears either on the op-ed page of the newspaper, that old-fashioned thing, or that write editorials for the paper. That is what we're doing here. Is it's commentary, it is opinion, and that's fine as long as that's clearly what it is. But that there's a difference between doing that and being a journalist. Do you think that if that distinction ever was there, now that doesn't, it's not as clear as it once was?
Oh, I think it's very unclear. Bloggers didn't really get into this because they wanted to be journalists. But because what they do sometimes appears or looks like journalism, there was a blurring of the lines almost immediately. So there's a lot of debate about, you know, whether bloggers should act more like journalists or you know, they should be taken seriously like journalists. Bloggers are bloggers. You know, they never wanted to be sort of the foreign correspondent for the New York Times. They're going to do opinion. They're going to do some original reporting. They're going to rally around candidates. They're going to raise money. They're going to do a little bit of everything. They're activists. They're media critics. They're reporters. They're opinion writers. They're all of that. And sometimes it overlaps with old-fashioned journalism, and sometimes it doesn't. And I realize that it can be confusing for readers, but I think the best way to understand it is they've created their own space and their own approach. And this debate about whether, you know, they should be more like journalists or not, it doesn't really fit because that's not what they're doing. They're doing some journalism, and when they do original reporting, then absolutely it should be able to withstand the typical scrutiny that any traditional news site would use. But that doesn't mean they can't then turn around and, you know, raise money for a congressional candidate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it gets us back to this question of what is the motivation? What is it that folks who are dedicated bloggers want to be doing, and whether in fact they feel that they have been able to do what it is that they would say that they're trying? It's a very clumsy question, but whether in fact their goals, their aspirations, they would say that they've been fulfilled.
Yeah, well, in terms of liberal bloggers, it's simple. I mean, they're just trying to create a progressive agenda, a progressive majority in America. They feel like America is essentially a center-left country, and that's not reflected in the politics and the initiatives and the media coverage of the country. So they're doing everything they can to sort of create a center-left country in terms of electing more liberals to Congress, not necessarily Democrats, but more liberals, supporting liberal initiatives, supporting liberal presidents, and trying to get a media debate that does not sort of robotically echo Republican talking points on virtually every issue. So have they been successful? I think they would say it's been mixed. Bloggers are not big into self-reflection. They're certainly even less interested in sort of patting themselves on the back. But I do think the landscape, the political landscape, would look much different if that liberal blogosphere, and particularly the larger progressive Netroots movement, was not born online in, say, 2002. They clearly have had a big impact on the debate and the media coverage. That said, they still would say there's a long way to go, and they still get frustrated and depressed that they're still fighting the same battles they've been fighting for year after year. So I think they would say it's a mixed bag, but I don't think you can't look back at the last few years and not acknowledge the extraordinary impact that they've had.
There, we will have to leave it because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Eric Bollert, is a senior fellow for Media Matters for America. He writes extensively about media and politics. He's also written for Salon and Rolling Stone. If you'd like to read the book that we're talking about here, the title is Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press, published by Free Press. And Mr. Bollert, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.